Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Srila Prabhupada, as in many purports and in many of his conversations, is praising Vedic civilization. Prabhupada says here that it's aesthetic even on the fighting front. That doesn't suit modern warfare, where the soldiers, they dress in this green and brown kind of uniform, so that the idea is they won't be seen. But here we see it's just the opposite. Maharaj Parikshit is going out, and he has his particular dvajam, pennant, which is marked by a lion. Just like Arjuna, when you've seen Arjuna's, just in the battle, you see there's a whole sea of warriors, and you can see the flag is flying. There's Hanuman. That means that's Arjuna's chariot. Or if you see, even from a distance, there's a military procession going, and you see there's a pennant that's marked with a palm tree. And then you know that's Balaram, or with Garuda Krishna. So you can, it's understood. Just like you have the Austrian flag, now I came to understand, it's red background with a white cross. So, that immediately, when they're looking at the car number plate, you can understand, oh, he's from Austria. So it's, and if you just have to know, that's all, what it is. If you don't know what it is, then it doesn't mean anything. But it's the symbol. The symbol stands for something. The symbol, that red background with a white cross, that is a symbol. There's some black in there also?
Symbol for
Janet. Hmm? That's Janet. Is it? Okay. Alright. Anyway, it's...
A little black in there.
Okay, so that... Ultimately, it has no intrinsic relationship with Austria, but it's been... Austria also, it's an arbitrary... Upadhi, designation. It's an arbitrary designation. Austria used to be much bigger, and now it means it's about the size of one. Just previously in Germany, it's still like Bayern and Schleswig-Holstein and like this. So it's like a. Sorry, not meaning to insult the Austrians here, but it's a small, it's like an area or a kingdom of one country. But anyway, at the present time, this particular area, which is, if you look on the map, you'll see Austria. So that's represented by this flag. And when people see that flag, and then they identify with Austria. And that may evince different emotions. Austria doesn't evince much emotions in anyone, I don't think. Maybe in the Austrians, but if you see the Star Spangled Banner, then if you go in America, and then you see in the rural areas, people are flying their American flags. They feel very proud. We are American, and then in many places they'll burn that also. It's not uncommon for the American flag to get burned here and there by people who don't feel very happy about America for various reasons. So actually, it doesn't do any harm to America to burn the flag, or it doesn't it doesn't enhance America to fly the flag. But people identify; it's become identified with that area of country which is called America, and the people who have called themselves Americans. So similarly with Austria or any other country. So in the same way, Maharaj Parikshit had his lion pennant, and that identified him. So that was the fighting system that would be seen. And then it's not just aesthetic. Prabhupada says aesthetic, but there's a point to that also, because the leading fight, or the chariot fighters, they would have a pennant on their chariot, and then it's seen who they are. One reason is so that you can identify them, and depending on which side you're on, they're either friend or enemy. Because otherwise, if there's just a bunch of chariots in the middle of they all get mixed up, and you don't know who's a friend and who's an enemy, and you don't know whether to shoot or not. Just like Lord Ram with Vali and Sugriva. And you know that story, how Sugriva, it's quite a complex story, so I just get the gist. So Sugriva was a monkey king who had been unfairly banished by his brother Vali. So then Lord Ram agreed to help him to kill Vali. So he said that, well, you just go out, you call him, you go and call him and fight with him, and then when he comes out, I'll shoot him. Because Vali was much stronger than Sugriva. Vali could easily kill Sugriva. So they went and they fought and they fought, and Lord Ram didn't shoot. And eventually Sugriva got away, and Vali said, I'll let you live because you're my brother. He said, why didn't you shoot? I couldn't tell the difference. You look just the same. When you're fighting together, you just look the same size. You know, I didn't want to play Russian roulette and end up killing you instead of him. So put on this garland and then you go back again, then I'll know who's who. So there's some means of identification. So that's one reason. And also, particularly the main person, the commander-in-chief, if you see him on the battlefield, that will give much inspiration to the fighters. They see him, they see particularly he's in difficulty, they will go and protect him. Just like at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Balang Bhima Birakshitam, that our army is well protected by the strength of Bhima Sen. So they know that particularly Yudhishthira Maharaj, he wasn't on the Kurukshetra battlefield, he wasn't the best fighter. It's known that Arjuna was the best fighter and Bhima was the strongest fighter. In terms of skill, Arjuna was best. And in terms of brute force, Bhima was the best on the Kurukshetra, on the Pandava side. So Yudhishthira, his chariot that had to be protected, he'd be out there, the whole battle was being fought for him. If he was killed or if he was captured, then there's not much point in the battle, because the whole idea was that he would win or lose, and on the basis of that the issue would be decided. The battle was to put him on the throne. So it was required that the dvaja, the pennant, that be seen by everyone. And also it points to the mode of fighting, that it was what you could call a civilized mode of fighting. Now that doesn't sound very civilized, does it, to say a civilized mode of fighting? Now you just fight in a civilized way. It's considered that fighting by its nature is uncivilized. But actually, to maintain civilization, fighting is required. Because some people are not civilized. And if you just allow people to do what they like, then some people will take advantage of that. That's why Prabhupada, you see this Gandhi, he's lauded all over the world as such a great personality. And Prabhupada just thought he's a fool. Because he has this idea of non-violence. But if you say non-violence, then immediately someone will come and take advantage of that. And that was proven. Actually, this Gandhi, in retrospect, it's seen that he is the cause of so many problems to India. He was supposed to be the father of the nation, they call him. But his stupid policies caused so much trouble. What happened is, after the partition of India, which Gandhi wasn't for that, but when it was done, that all the weapons, the whole armory was in India. And then the Pakistani said, well, you know, give us our share. He said, forget it. We're keeping it all. And all the money too. All the money is with us and all the weapons are with us. And then Gandhi went on one of his fasts to death. That if you don't give it to them, we have to be fair. If you don't give them their share of the money and weapons, then I'm going to fast to death. And then out of respect, then they gave it to the Pakistanis, who did what? Attacked India immediately. So he was the cause of the loss of so many lives for his ahimsa and fairness policy. If you be fair to a rascal, then he'll mistreat you. He'll use it against you. He'll take it as a sign of weakness. We see that always, that this Vina Maharaj that's described in the Bhagavatam, that he was very cruel. He was too heavy. He was too fascistic, we'd say in the modern age. He was, but one thing was that when he was around, there weren't any thieves. And then he was killed for being too much of a rascal. But then the other, all the smaller rascals, they took advantage. All the thieves came out, and there's no one to stop us now, so they came out and they exploited the situation. It's the same in the communist times. We hear all over Eastern Europe and Russia how there was no freedom of movement, there was no freedom of speech or freedom of anything pretty much in the communist time. I mean, you were free to go and pass urine, but that was about it. The no freedom meant that also the criminals had no freedom. I mean, apart from the people who are in the government, but they're authorized criminals. So, but regular street attacking and mugging and all this kind of thing, that didn't take place because the government was very strict. And then as soon as this system was dismantled, then the mafia took all these countries are run by, Russia is run by, it's a nexus between the government and the mafia. And so many countries like that. And the common thing that a businessman, he has to pay the mafia so much money. Otherwise, it's called protection money. That means that it's protection, that you're protected from us. That if you don't give us money, then we'll shoot you. And if you do, then we'll make sure that no one else shoots you, because we need your money. We need your contribution to the good cause of upholding the mafia. So these things can flourish as long as there's no strong king. Therefore, kshatriyas are required to protect. Fighting is required in civilization. There can be no civilization unless everyone is civilized by nature, which is, it doesn't happen in them. From Treta Yuga onwards, it didn't happen. In Satya Yuga, there was no need of a police force. Everyone was a Paramahamsa, practically. Then from Treta Yuga on, it became necessary that there was organization, there were kings and armies and all this kind of thing. Even armies means there was a small martial caste, the Kshatriyas. And others, they would be just, they wouldn't be like permanent army taking up one third of the budget of the country. But they would be at home and doing their work. And then when the time was required for fighting, they'd be called up. That's all. Not that they were full-time engaged. And there wasn't so much necessity either, because that was the system everywhere. So in this way they kept their troops. They didn't just have huge armies of people doing nothing most of the time and taking up huge amounts of money, doing nothing and bored and then smoking dope. And then that's all. That's what armies do mostly in the Western world. And I've seen in Bangladesh, I saw the army, the only purpose of that army was to keep the citizens under control, because the police force was not able to do so. So it was just because they're surrounded by India, and India, any time they want, they can take over Bangladesh. There's no hope. The Bangladesh army has no hope to resist them. But they don't want to, because it's just a bag of problems, so they just leave it there. So this army, it's just, in the modern age, army is either it's just a massive thing for that's not used most of the time, or in many cases it's just used to uphold some tyrant in many countries. So it's a long cry, a far cry from the armies of the Vedic times, in which they would come out to fight and very aesthetically decorated, and because they fought according to certain rules. It's not that just like you see nowadays, they have this green and brown uniform so no one can see them, because as soon as you see them, you're shot. they'll shoot at you. But in Vedic times, you don't shoot someone in the back. You face to face. That was a military code until recently. Only till very recently. Even recently, you'll see in European history, the fighters that have bright red jackets. And different. There's the cavalry and the infantry, and they'd have all different uniforms. So they can be seen who they are. They're not hiding away because they know there's the rules of chivalry that you only face to face. Then you can shoot. And there are so many rules that if a cavalry fighter is down from his horse or down from his chariot, then only a cavalry soldier, he will fight with another cavalry soldier. And then only if he's on his chariot, like that. So there are so many rules to be followed, because they fought in a civilized manner. It wasn't killed by any means, but in a fair manner, according to the code of Kshatriyas. In other words, even fighting was conducted according to the code of Dharma. That if you fight in this way, then, what is that? Hatova bhokshasi. Hatova prapshasi svargam. Jidvamva bhokshasi mahim. Krishna told Arjuna, if you're killed in the battle, then you go to the heavenly planets. And if you're victorious, then you'll enjoy the earth. So you don't go to the heavenly planets if you shoot people in the back. You go to the hellish planets. And you're in hellish consciousness. But if someone's in civilized consciousness, then he fights, but only according to certain rules. I mean, the full endeavor. But they did. It wasn't. You can understand. It wasn't uncontrolled rage, because at every moment they're seeing who they can fight with. They're angry, but still they maintain that you have to fight. If you are fighting, you have to be angry. But they maintain their equal. Still, they maintain their sense of dharma. It wasn't just wild anger or just killing by any means. You design some bomb that goes and it finds the right spot and it kills all the people while they're sitting having their breakfast. So it wasn't like that. And while you're sitting and by some technological arrangement you just kill everyone. And they don't even know what's going on. So even you see, just like America attacks Iraq or this and that, they would only fight with the soldiers should fight with soldiers, not the civilian casualties. It's very demoniac, actually. Even, like I say, even till recently, they wouldn't have wars in which they wouldn't fight in such a way that the women and children were killed. You went to a certain place, just like a Kurukshetra, they went to a certain place and they fought. And that was it. And it was finished. And it wasn't that when the soldiers, the numbers start depleting, they start pulling out 8-year-old boys and women and all this. No, it's just, that's ridiculous. And there's nothing, and then the whole society is, there's nothing left. And the way modern warfare is, just like in the Second World War, the men were out fighting and the women were in the factories. And making guns and all this kind of thing. But it's an over-endeavor. It was limited war in previous times. There was a limited fighting, and then, alright, our army lost, okay, we're finished. Not that they'd pull out the whole population when there's just, you know, a few chickens left, and then they surrender. A few chickens and cats and dogs, and okay, now there's nothing left. So they didn't fight like it was. I mean, fighting is not very sane or palatable, but it's required, and it was done according to civilized guidelines. So it was aesthetic. I mean, they dressed up so nicely and all this. Of course, it soon got disordered. That's described in Krishna book how. When Krishna was fighting, there'd be rivers of blood. And all the crowns and the jewelry would be floating in that. So, he looked very nice. But soon their bodies would be covered with blood in various ways. But that's also considered a decoration for a kshatriya. We'll find for a kshatriya that's considered something very noble. A king, he would lead the army in the battle, and he would come back with some injuries, and that's considered, you see, that's a sign that he's a real king. Just like, this is a little bit of a perversion, but I remember as a kid going to Glasgow, which was, I don't know if now, but at the time it was the most violent and wretched city in Great Britain. Not including Northern Ireland, there, every young man, it was expected that you have a scar on your face. That was because, you know, you have to have some sign that you've been in some serious fights. Otherwise, you're not a real man. So, like that, the kshatriyas, they had to come back with some injuries and some... That's described about Balaram when he was fighting with Dravida. That Dravida smashed a tree on his head and blood came out and looked very beautiful. So we don't think it looks very beautiful, but kshatriyas, they think, yeah, this is nice. They have a different way of thinking, because they're that mood, it's a very strong mood, just like we read yesterday. The kshatriyas, they like to fight. They have that spirit that they like to fight. It's for them. They're trained for that. They want to do that. Recently, about a year ago, there was some military, what would you call it? It was more than a skirmish. It was a few days of serious fighting in Kashmir, between India and Pakistan. And it was described that because they have cantonments all over the country in India. So the soldiers, they were coming up to their officers, and the officers were going to their high officers and said, please send me, I want to go there. They're eager to fight. They don't want to sit in the cantonment. They say, I've been trained for this, you know, I mean, this is what I've been trained for, to fight. Now I want to go. So they want to go in a situation where their life is in danger. It's actually very dangerous, because the Pakistanis were holding the position in the mountain, and the only way to attack them was to climb up the mountain while you're being shot at down here. So they had some casualties, but eventually they threw them out. I mean, the Indians threw the Pakistanis out. But the point I'm making here, that they were actually very eager, that we want to, that spirit is that we want to go and fight. It wasn't that we hear of Vedic civilization, we think of rishis sitting very peacefully in the forest. They were sitting peacefully in the forest because the kshatriyas, they were able to do that because the kshatriyas were protecting them. They were protecting the whole civilization. And even in the forest, the kshatriyas would come and clean out excess violent animals. So that was the duty of the kshatriyas. And they felt a great pride in doing that. They were really powerful persons. Prabhupada told so many stories. Prabhupada, he admired that kshatriya spirit. Once he visited one Maharaj in Punjab, and he saw there were so many tiger heads on his wall. And he said, Prabhupada said, oh, where did these come from? He said, I shot all these tigers. Oh, you shot them. Very nice. Even to shoot with a gun, it's you have to have a lot of bravery to go out. Because it's one thing looking at a tiger or a lion in a zoo, but going out in the forest, and then of course the tiger may jump on you from behind because they don't follow kshatriya codes. But it's, you know, they're very frightening animals. You have to have a lot of courage to go out and face them. So this Prabhupada was admiring that. He said, oh, that's very good. That's real kshatriya spirit. Prabhupada, he was also sometimes praising the kshatriyas, the Sikhs, they would, especially that last Sikh guru, Guru Govinda. So he was practically on the battlefield. He was disemboweled. Someone cut his stomach, but he held it in and went on fighting, and then dropped dead. Fight out to the last. So that's that spirit is very that. Prabhupada Noda means everyone in India knows. There are certain people who they have a very, even today they have a very strong Kshatriya spirit. That's the Gurkhas in Nepal, they're known. The British army runs on Gurkhas, actually. I mean, if they really want some fighting done, they call in the Gurkhas, the Nepali martial caste. So they have such a strong Kshatriya spirit. There was some story came in the Falkland Islands. Do you remember? It was about 86 or something like that. Maybe there was some islands in the middle of the South Atlantic, supposedly owned by the British, and then the Argentinians invaded. And then the British went and they took it back after a few days. So, but they had to fight a little bit, at least. So the story came from that there was a parish, there was a troop of Gurkhas, and the British army officers said to them that, well, we're going to fly you over the Argentinian position and drop you there. So this is a very dangerous mission because, you know, you're dropped and they can just shoot at you. So who's volunteering? And only half of them volunteered. And, you know, I thought, so you're all going to volunteer? Why is it only half? He said, well, if you drop us out of the plane, we'll all, you know, we'll all die. He said, well, you have parachutes. Oh, okay. Then we'll all volunteer. So I don't know if it's true, but that story, but that just shows the spirit that they're so much willing to fight. They have a very strong martial spirit. So that spirit that was maintained, you'll find the Gurkhas Jats. There's in North India. There's Jats. Most of the Sikhs they're called Jats, and they're a certain class of military people. And the Marathas, these three people in India, they're very famous for fighting. If there's any need of fighting, they'll fight. And then Marathi Brahmanas, there were Brahmanas all over India. And Brahmana and Vaishya spirit is a Brahmana spirit means he'll Prabhupada described that also. There's in Krishnanagar there was one king and he went to visit one Brahmana. And the Brahmana was just you see, the king, he lives in a big palace, and the Brahmana, he lives in just a little hut. So he said, well, is there anything I can do for you? Anything, anyway? He said, no, nothing you can do for me. You're just living in this little hut, and how are you living? He said, well, I have a little, make a hut from grass, and my disciples, brahmacharis, they go out and beg a little rice and dal every day. And we get some from the forest, there's some leaves. We're living. The kshatriya cannot imagine, but the brahman is quite satisfied. Whatever is necessary for living, I'll live and go on with our studies, studying shastra, teaching others. That was the brahmana spirit. And Vaishya spirit, Prabhupada also described that one man in Calcutta, he somehow in business he lost everything. It can happen, especially in the modern business syndrome. He lost everything. So he went to his friend and asked that you please give me a loan to start my new business. So at that time there was a plague in Calcutta and the government had given some scheme that the plague is caused by rats. So anyone who brings a dead rat to the government office, they will get something, one anna or something, some small amount of money. So the man pointed to him and said, looked in the street, so there's a dead rat. He said, you see that dead rat? That is your capital for starting your new business. Take that and begin. I'm not giving you any loan. That's your capital. So he took the dead rat, took it to the government office, got his one anna, and started his business. And within a short time, that became one of the most famous aristocratic business families in Calcutta. He took it, he bought something wholesale, sat on the side of the street, sold it retail, and then just took a small amount for maintaining his family, invested the balance, and like this, gradually built up. Recently, one of the most famous businessman in India. He died just over a year ago, actually. So he's same thing. The family came from Pakistan at the time of partition, and they came with nothing. They're lucky to have their skins still on them, still on their body. They were, if anyone could, mostly all rich, so many rich families, but they came with nothing. And then he was working hard, and eventually he became the biggest businessman, at least one of the top five in India. It's a household name. It's, I don't remember, Dhirambhai Ambani, something like that. So that spirit, they're able, they immediately, they get some money, and immediately they think, oh, how to invest, how to build up. That spirit is very strong. So this Brahmana spirit, Kshatriya spirit, Vaishya spirit, people who've got that spirit, then they'll automatically work in a certain kind of way. That sometimes our Grihastha devotees are saying that, well, you know, we have to start business and ISKCON should help us. If you're a Vaishya, if you're actually a businessman, you don't need ISKCON's help or anyone's help. You'll do it. And if you're not a businessman by nature, you can take all the help and you'll spoil all the money. Because if you think I need some help, that means you're not a businessman. Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, by nature, they're independent. And someone, if they say, we need your help, that means you're a Shudra, actually, by nature. ISKCON has to support me. If you're thinking like that, then that means Shudra mentality. Someone has to support me. Of course, if someone is working, say, as a temple president or whatever, maybe a Grihastha, there may be some maintenance. But if his first thought is, oh, I have to get some maintenance, then he's not fit for the job. If he's thinking, I'll do service, and then automatically whatever Krishna sends, we'll take, then he's fit for the job. Shudra mentality. What, first of all, what do I get? How do I get? But the Vaishya, Kshatriya or Brahmana, they're first of all thinking, what do I do? What is my duty? How do I have to do something for human society? And then automatically the reciprocation will be there. So this, especially the Kshatriya and Brahmana, very essential in human society. And until recently, at least, that those Kshatriya type families were there in Europe, but then they became dissipated by sense gratification. There were so many kings and barons and dukes and all over Europe, but they lost their, they had some potency previously, but they lost it because they indulged in unrestricted sense gratification. Kshatriyas allowed sense gratification, but in a restrained way. You may think, well, they may have 20 wives, so it doesn't sound very restrained. That's restrained. Because it may sound, well, I know that's a lot of wives, but he has a lot of energy. Prabhupada explained that the Kshatriyas, they're very energetic because they eat lots of vitaminous foods, to use Prabhupada's words. There's no such word in English as vitaminous, but Prabhupada invented it. So they have a lot of bodily strength, and so they may have 20 wives, but they don't. They'll only consort with their wives according to religious principles at certain time, and only with their wife, not here, there, and everywhere. So they're following the religious principles, and they had their palaces and their wives and their paraphernalia and so many things, but they also had a duty to perform with that. Prabhupada, he often said that the modern governments, they have no right to tax the people, or any government, they have no right to tax the people unless they can protect them. The government is taking money, but you can't be sure that when you walk on the street that no one's going to come up and take whatever the government didn't loot from you, someone else will loot from you. You can't be sure. Because it's a common thing. Maybe not in Vienna, because the police are pretty heavy here. That's one reason, maybe. But in many cities of the world, especially the so-called more civil, paragons of modern life, cities like New York and London, It's not safe to walk on the street, even in the daytime in many areas. What to speak of at night? Because someone will, it's quite likely someone's going to, you know, just walk up to you with a knife and say, give me your money. And that's it. You either give the money or they give you the knife. And then take your money. So the government has no right to take your tax money unless they can protect you. They should create a situation. But in the name of liberality, they've created a situation in which no one is safe. This Narnidhar Prabhu was telling me, he met one man who he used to be in Sweden. He used to be the one top detective. And the man was telling him, I'm disgusted. I'll never work with this government because I spent 2 years investigating all the top drug dealers in this country. And then we busted them. And we turned them in. And then they went to court. And then he got a lawyer. And the lawyer said that he's mentally disturbed. And then he got not only acquitted, but he got money from the government for being mentally disturbed. So, I mean, the man is a criminal. It's clear he's a criminal. But in the name of liberality, be nice, they let him go. So then he'll be doing the same thing. Or what's very common is that these drug dealers, they get arrested and they go to prison and they run their business from the prison. They go on running the same business, and then after some time they come out. And there was an uproar in America. That was maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. This Charles Manson, he was acquitted on parole. This Charles Manson, he killed some ritual murders, some horrible murders of Sharon Tate and some famous actor in Hollywood. And they killed and they wrote, kill the pigs in with their blood. They wrote it on the wall. And there was some nasty guy. Unfortunately, he went into court chanting Hare Krishna. So it didn't do much good for our movement. But anyway, he was definitely mentally disturbed, but he'd been in prison about 15 years, and they let him out on parole. So he didn't do anything wrong in prison, he didn't kill anyone, so, you know, let him out. So this is the people, why should they give taxes to such a government? You can't protect them. These are all, you may think, well, you know, what's all this got to do with Krishna consciousness? All this. But Prabhupada discussed these subjects in quite some detail because Prabhupada's idea of spreading Krishna consciousness was that the whole society should become Krishna conscious and it should be set up according to Vedic principles. And then therefore Prabhupada spent a lot of time writing about and discussing about how Vedic society is set up. Because he wanted us to actually institute this. And again, it looks like, if we look out the window, it doesn't look like anyone's ready to take it up. But Prabhupada had that vision, that whole countries will become Krishna conscious. So that was the challenge that Prabhupada gave to us. That we have to make whole countries Krishna conscious, whole world Krishna conscious. That was actually Prabhupada's mission. That he would, and then how should it be governed? According to democracy, communism, or what? According to the Vedic system. So for that it's required, Prabhupada said, first of all, there should be an ideal class of brahmanas. And Prabhupada gave the prescription how to be an ideal brahmana. That means rising early, being fixed in religious principles. That means minimum 4 regulative principles. A life fully dedicated to spiritual life, which means Krishna consciousness. And then all these qualities as given in Bhagavad Gita. Ideal class of brahmanas who can guide society. So we see that the brahmana, just like Vyasadeva, he was writing his books. He had a big job to write and edit so many books. But when he was also requested, sometimes he would come. We find in Mahabharata, Vyasa writes about himself. How he would come, right? He writes about himself in the third person. How he would come and he would, just like yesterday I was saying, he came and he told Drupada Maharaj how Drupada Maharaj didn't want to marry Draupadi, his daughter, to 5 husbands And then Vyas came. There, no one else could convince him, so Vyas came and said, actually, this is required. It should be done. So from time to time, Vyas himself would come and give directions. What should be done? What are the principles of dharma? So we see that the brahmanas, they were, even though they were fully involved in spiritual activities, they weren't aloof from human society. They were involved. They were involved means they were, the brahmanas would mostly be living in the forests, but some would be living in the city also to guide the kings. But they, even if they're living in the forest, they would not be deep in the forest, but at the edge of the village or the town. And people would go and see them and take advice. And they themselves would be training up the brahmacharis, who would be the ideal citizens by getting that brahmachari training. And mostly, when we talk about brahmanas, they're mostly also grihasthas. They were living in the forest with their wives. The rishis, they're mostly married like that. So they were not otherworldly to the extent that they were totally disinvolved from human society. Rather, one of the main reasons they studied was not simply for their own enlightenment, but so that they could give knowledge to others of how to live in human society, how to live their lives in such a way that they could live more or less peacefully as much as possible or even more important, because sometimes war is required, fighting is required, kshatriyas, but even more important than living peacefully, they would live according to the principles of dharma. And of course the highest manifestation of dharma is Krishna consciousness. So the brahmanas, they were giving guidance to society, practical, and not impractical. Their minds away somewhere else, but very practically giving guidance to human society in all aspects. Dronacharya was teaching how to fight. It's also a Vedic art. So Prabhupada, we see that although he was pointing the way to Krishna, Aṁ tad Vishnu paramang padang sadā paśyanti suryo divīva cakṣurātatam, those who are devotees, they're always looking up to the spiritual world, to Krishna, but they're also looking to human society and how to guide in a way that each individual will properly, to the best extent, fulfill his human form of life. And how the whole society will integrate so the whole society can be geared up for that purpose of fulfilling the goal of life. So when we're talking about all these things, it's not just some nice stories how Parikshit Maharaj was going out, but actually it's supposed to give guidance to human society, how we should re-establish the principles of dharma. Varnashram dharma should be established so that it makes it easy for people to become Krishna conscious. That just by living their ordinary life, svai svai kamani bhirata saṃsiddhim labhate naraha, just by living one's life, ordinary activities, one can worship the Supreme Lord by that activity and become purified and attain perfection. So we should be aware of this. It seems to me that our movement at the present time, we're just trying to fit into modern society. But as I see it, Prabhupada's vision was that we don't fit into modern society, we're different. We should set up our own society, have our own way of life, our own show, or rather, instead of trying to have the public accept us, rather we should live according to our own principles and they should accept that, not that we have to adjust ourselves to them. Of course, living in the cities, then we are restricted in some ways, but Prabhupada wanted to set up these farm communities where devotees live as devotees with according to the standards given by Krishna in the Shastra, not that we have to live according to their standards. So that's a great mission that Prabhupada had. Yeah. Some people, they may think it's just impossible. But then it was impossible that Krishna consciousness could even be spread in the Western world at all. So Prabhupada has left us a lot of work to do. A lot of work. To establish Krishna conscious countries. Whole countries Krishna conscious. And living according to Vedic principles. So along with our cultivation of knowledge of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, this sambandha abhideya prayojan, this what is our relationship with Krishna, how to perform devotional service, and what is our ultimate goal, we should also cultivate knowledge of this Vedic culture and try to incorporate it in our lives as much as possible, so that we can gradually teach others about that. Hare Krishna. Is there any question about this? You have a question? Yeah. All right. Click on the mark.
So I've read from Srila Prabhupada's books that he said our society should be spiritual communism. And then I've also heard from devotees that that this doesn't work, actually. It doesn't work practically.
Yeah, well, spiritual communism means communism not according to Marxist theory. Yeah. What's Marx's book? What's his name of his famous book? Das Kapital. Yeah. So we don't, I mean, Prabhupada was giving a general idea when he said spiritual communism. Just like Marx, for instance, he said there would be one of Marx's principles, no family. No family. That just people have children and the children are communally brought up. In Korea, North Korea, they do that. Well, in traditional Vedic culture, not only Vedic culture, but all over the world, it was like that until fairly recently. But it's more like that's something like Advaitavad, that all the children become one. But the traditional system was Vishishta Advaita. Ramanuja's philosophy is Vishishta Advaita. All is one, but with some distinguishing characteristics also. So, they'd have big families. Big families means all the brothers live together and each brother has, you know, maybe 10 or 15 children. So they'd all be living together, so they'd all be part of one big family, but still they had their own particular father and mother. And in the village, just like I used to go in the villages in Bangladesh and someone would introduce me, this is my brother, and he'd introduce me, someone, this is also my brother. How many brothers have we got? The whole village. Because they call everyone their brother. So that in that sense, communism, but still he has his particular father. So that means that, what is that motto of communism? That everyone works according to his capacity and takes according to his need. So that principle is there. But it's modified in spiritual communism, that not... what is everyone's need is different to who they are. Brahmana's need is very little. And a Shudra also shouldn't be given very much. In many ways, Brahmanas and Shudras, they live similarly. They both live very simply. But Shudras have to live simply because if you give them more than they need, they'll misuse it. Because they have no sense of discrimination. And Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, they're quite wealthy. So... But actually the whole society works, just like I quoted that verse, Sve Sve Karmanya Bhirata Sangsidim Labhate Naraha. Everyone, by working, they can achieve perfection. How is that? Because in Vedic society, everything is aimed at yajna. Everyone works, and then the whole society comes together. The kings organize big yajnas, in which everyone attends, and everyone is involved. And everything that everyone produces is offered in the form of grains and ghee in the fire. And then they get the blessings of Vishnu and of the demigods. And everything goes on nicely in society. So everyone cooperated together, not simply for their gross material needs, but they cooperated to perform yajnas for the satisfaction of Vishnu. So if the king is good, then he will automatically attract brahmanas to come and be... Brahmanas, they're looking for a good king. Just like the Pandavas, they set up their new kingdom, Indraprastha. There was no one there. They just went and they... But immediately so many brahmanas came because they thought, well, Yudhishthira is a good king. We'll be protected so we can go on with our spiritual activities, and we'll give guidance to someone who's very fit to... If we guide Yudhishthira, then he's a person who'll take what we say seriously. He's a very pure king. And by serving... By being a brahmana in Yudhishthira's kingdom, he'll perform so many yajnas, and by cooperation with such a king, then our purpose will be fulfilled. So this is how Vedic society worked. It's very fascinating, actually. It's a different kind of paradigm altogether to communism, capitalism, or any such thing. It's communism, yeah, but with not according to Marxist theory, but rather everyone cooperates together to serve Vishnu. But it's not that they artificially try to make everyone the same. Rather, it's much more sensible to recognize that there are differences between people, and that people should take up different roles according to their capability, and people should live according to the mode that's befitting them, instead of trying to make everyone the same. Now they're women's rights, women equal to men, but Prabhupada would point out that, well, there is at least one significant difference between women and men, and that women have children and men don't. And when they have the child, then it's the natural tendency of the mother to look after the child. She has to feed with her body, the man doesn't. So she's required to look after children. That's the natural function of the... So then it's required that she needs a man to protect. This is not even Shastra. This is just, we can say, natural biology or whatever you want to call it. So to try to make artificially equal, I mean, and then women should have careers, but... But in the natural course, they'd be having children instead of having careers and becoming the head of a multinational corporation or something like that. They can only do that if either they're not using the function of their body, which is to have children, and then you have contraception and so many things which are sinful. So, and Prabhupada also pointed out, he used to joke about women policemen, policewomen. And actually, Niranjan Maharaj was telling me that now they have women firemen, firewomen. But so they do all their training and everything, but there's just one problem, is that when it comes time for the fire, the hose is so heavy they can't pick it up. And you have to have a certain amount of physical strength to do that job. But the average... I mean, they don't even allow every man to do it. You have to be a strong man. You have to have a certain bodily build. But the average, you know, it's very few women who can do that. Of course, now in the West, it's popular women do bodybuilding, which is very strange. And we can understand they go to beauty parlors and this kind of thing, but bodybuilding, that's very strange. But anyway, I mean, maybe 50% of men can lift up the fire hose and hold it like this, because it's heavy, it's full of water, it's not so light. But then maybe only about 5% of women can, because women, their bodies are also strong in a different way. It's said that a man couldn't bear a child, a woman can do that, so their body is strong in a different... But to artificially make it one, it's actually ridiculous. So there are so many anomalies in modern society. It's very unpopular if you say this kind of thing, that, you know, women are not equal to men. If you go outside the door, then there's no hope. But even inside ISKCON, if you say these things nowadays, because they want to make it all one. Now they want to make that... Now there's propaganda that ISKCON should become very accommodating to homosexuals and all this kind of thing. There's a lot of propaganda, actually. It's going on. Yeah. So... It's called being politically correct, that we should go along with the Kami society, and, you know, we should be fair to everyone and nice. And But it's actually straightforward. Homosexuals, it's fine. You can chant Hare Krishna. We have no objection. But if you want to be an active homosexual, then there's no Krishna conscience because there's no scope for it. You get the point? If someone has that inclination, well, that's your bad karma. And that's the way, alright, that's the way you feel. But you can't indulge in it. If you have heterosexual tendencies, they can be indulged, not only indulged, but that can be used in a religious way. Dharma viruddha, what is that? Kama viruddha bhuteshu kamosmi bharatarshapa. Producing children for bringing up in Krishna consciousness. Krishna says, I am that. That is religious. But there's no religious way to indulge in homosex. It's demoniac. So you can be a homosexual and chant Hare Krishna, but you just have to stop any homosexual activity. That's all. There's no way to. And they want to have that. They've come up with the theory that we encourage. This is the Galva. It's the Galva is the Gay and Lesbian Vaishnava Association. Yes, we are under onslaught from these things. So they've come up with the theory that we encourage homosexual Vaishnavs and Vaishnavis to, not to indulge in sex. But if you can't restrain yourself, then live with one partner and go on chanting Hare Krishna. That will be better. So they say that we're just being practical because, there are so many homosexuals and they can't all restrain themselves. So it sounds very practical, but what is the defect in this argument? Anyone like to say? What is the defect?
Breaking regular,
there's no prescription for it in Shastra. In Shastra, if you can't be a lifelong brahmachari, actually in many places in Shastra it says you should get married. Even Prabhupada says that in this first canto. It says everyone should be married. So if you can't, if you are not going to be a lifelong brahmachari, then you should get married, and the sexual proclivity, that will be indulged in a religious manner. But there's no religious manner. There's no prescription in Shastra for homosexual activity. In fact, it's described as demoniac. So these are some of the defects. So we should push this the Vedic standard very strongly. Not be compromised by modern society, which after all is demoniac. And we just want to say it plainly, because the goal of life in modern society is not to become Krishna conscious. It's to become more and more sinful. So, and they're trying to say this is Vedic. In Vedic culture, there were homosexuals and this and that. So they're trying to say it's actually part of Vedic society, although Hare Krishna. Even if it might have been, it was. I mean, first of all, it's not encouraged in Vedic culture, there were eunuchs that Arjuna, he took the position of a eunuch, but that's not exactly the same as a homosexual. That's called, there's a word for that in Sanskrit, it's called noipunsak. It means to have no sexuality. It means young men who are castrated in their youth, like young bulls, they're castrated. So, that was it. But very clearly it's stated in Prabhupada's books that homosexuality is demoniac. So you may be born with that or whatever. But that's your, that's bad luck. We're all sinful having come to this world, and homosexuality is more sinful. So, all right, we don't hate you because of that, but you can chant Hare Krishna, but you can't indulge in it. There's no prescription for that. So somehow or other we came to this unfortunate topic at the end of this class. But, it is around. There are certain people who want to infiltrate ISKCON with all these demoniac ideas. So be careful. Watch out. And by the way, I must say, like I say, you can I can get tomatoes thrown at me, rotten eggs thrown at me, even within ISKCON for this, and I've already had plenty thrown at me. But actually this women's liberation, that's also a bogus idea. That women should be exactly the same as... No, they have a different social role. Spiritually equal opportunity, but socially different role. Very clear. Not all one.
That's what in Vedic culture, there are many kings. And if there is one king who is more powerful and more popular than the other ones, he'd be like emperor.
Yeah.
And all the other kings would be some kind of...
Yeah, Yudhishthira was the emperor. So there, and there were sub-kings under him. Yeah.
And they, and those sub-kings, they would pay some tribute to the emperor.
Yeah.
So... what are the fundamental differences between that and the mafia?
What is the difference between rule by a king in Vedic times and the mafia? What is the difference between a pious king and a despot? Both have absolute power. But one uses it to uplift the society, and one uses it simply for his own sense gratification and exploitation. That's the difference. One rules according to religious principles and the other rules for his own sense gratification. Which is why the system of kings broke down in Europe and all over the world. Because they were at one time ruling on behalf of the church.
Like the mafia.
Yeah, well the church was like the mafia also. But, but at least there was some... they had some idea. I mean, society in Europe was very religious at one point. If you see all the very old buildings all over Europe, it's churches and castles. That's all. The ordinary people, they wouldn't have such a nice building as they made for God. And the castle was for the protection of the kings, but otherwise all the art, all the nice architecture, everything was for the glorification of God. Of course, their idea of glorification had gotten a little strange with it. But anyway, the idea that you see, just yesterday we saw some beautiful church. Actually, so they were their artistic tendency that was used for the glory and money also. I mean, you have to spend a lot of money to build these churches. So that was there. That tendency was there. But then, when they simply ruled for their own sense gratification, then eventually the people said, first thing, they didn't care about the people, and then the French Revolution came, and the people are starving. There's no bread for them to eat. Then let them eat cake. That famous thing from the French Revolution. They didn't care about the people at all. And then they just rounded up all the aristocracy and chopped off their heads because they're so frustrated. The Vedic rulers, they were so much taking care of the people that they were making sure that there was no justice in the kingdom, and they had enough food and everything. They were treated like their children, and the people reciprocated. They liked that very much. It's a much better system to have one ruler who you know and you can deal with, and you know who cares for you, and people like that. Rather than having some impersonal government, someone comes in for a few years and then he goes out again, and they have no power to protect you even if they wanted to. If they wanted to make some law that now just like there's no capital punishment in most countries, it's considered very wrong, but actually it's demoniac not to have capital punishment. It's required to curb the miscreants. And they say this Islamic law is very bad because if you're caught stealing, they chop off your hand and you won't steal again. That's it, finished. And people won't want to steal. So you can't have laws like that. The whole society is so ridiculous. I mean, on the one hand, it's illegal to have rape. Okay, we agree with that. But then they have porno shops everywhere. And even the TV is like, why go to a porno shop? Just turn on the TV. Or just open any magazine. So they're, on one hand, they're filling people's minds with all these bad thoughts. And on the other hand, when they can't control They're pushing them. Don't control, don't control, don't control. And when they go completely out of hand, then it's, what do you expect? And they're saying, no, rape is very bad. Or they're encouraging it. So it's a completely ridiculous society. Anything else? Yeah.
We're talking about this Kshatriyas group.
Mm.
And is there, I mean, there must be ways how to engage these indigenous groups.
Oh, yeah.
In a modern way. I mean, Sankirtan, I can imagine, is one way to engage.
Kshatriya spirit, how to engage in Krishna's service. You mean in ISKCON today? Yeah, well, book distribution, Sankirtan. And, well, there's certainly scope for management. We need leaders. We need leaders. Actually fighting, well, there are devotees also in some of our centers who, they do the guard duty. They do the guard duty. They're trained up. In big centers, they have people like devotees who stay up all night and they do the guard duty. And I remember in London, in our Bury Place center, there was one devotee. He, because, you know, practically every day some guy would come in, some violent kind of guy, and he loved it. You know, they call him. He was the pujari come bouncer. So in between offering aartis, he would... He has these nunchakas, you know? This thing, this wooden thing. So, can be engaged. They're actually, because the modern society is set up in such a way, it's a little difficult to engage the Kshatriya spirit, because as fighting, who are you going to fight for? Are you going to go and fight for George Bush? There's... Now who's there to fight? Kshatriyas actually can't flourish without Brahmanas. Brahmanas. They have to protect Brahmanas, old men, women, cows, and children. They have to protect everyone, but particularly these five categories. But our so-called Kshatriyas, they're running governments and cow slaughter. How can they be Kshatriyas? Cow slaughter is just... Then they go to get slaughtered also by the law of karma. Anything else? Any protests from the ladies' side? You want to have women's living? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You should stand up and say, yes, we're against this women's liberation. They won't listen to me. I know, because I tried it. They should have listened to him. It's, as Prabhupada noted, it's actually a way to exploit the women, because we're all equal, and you know, and we just we all mix up together, and there's no rules and regulations for mixing. So I like you, and tomorrow I don't like you. I use you, and now you're pregnant. Okay, that's your problem, not mine. So it's actually it fosters irresponsibility. Another thing I'm very much against, I must say, which is very bad stain on our ISKCON, is actually that people get married and then they get divorced, which is actually very wrong and sinful. So, you probably, most of you are not married, are going to be married. So please bear it in mind that in Krishna consciousness, although it's become almost like normal in ISKCON, but it is absolutely wrong. You shouldn't do that. You get married and stay married, that's all. You can take sannyas when you're old, later. One time you get married, and then even if you throw the whole room at each other every day, you stay married. That's all. People used to do. There was no divorce previously. It's only in the modern society. Because they've given the people think, oh, other people are getting divorced, I should also get divorced. It's become a normal thing. But then there's no meaning to marriage in the first place. Many people don't bother getting married either. Why bother to get married? It's only a piece of paper, they say. It is not. Marriage means it's a religious, it's a sacred act. Marriage, in every Buddhism, Islam, there's a religious ceremony because it's supposed to be a sacred act. We're coming together responsibly to serve God together and to train children to serve God.